the lower 48 at least, that some of the most important things to the tribes there is the power to govern. And that power of governance is easily as important as the land base that is in question. And I think that's the question that was not adequately addressed in ANCSA and is left in somewhat disarray and confusion by all the events that have occurred since then.
Well, thank you, Mr. Johnson. That was an excellent supplement to what Mr. Jorgensen said. We can turn to you now, or if you'd like to start after lunch, whatever suits you.
Commissioner Bridger?
Yes.
Is John Stevens going to be here?
No.
Well, then I passed over the Passamaquoddy because I thought that he would be here. But I would like to just say a couple of things about it, and others can join in. It's crucial, and I think it's very important to Alaska Natives.
Please do.
When the first Court of Appeals affirmed the district court decision, they did the following. They said that the Passamaquoddy were a tribe, that the Non-Intercourse Act applied to the Passamaquoddy, that the federal government had a trust obligation to the Passamaquoddy, and that the United States could not deny Passamaquoddy's request for litigation against the state of Maine on the sole ground that there was no trust relationship. Now, the courts didn't decide the legality of the claim for the land or for its value, but it was put at, 12.5 million acres and several billion dollars, those 12.5 million acres. And it was recognized by President Ford that the Passamaquoddy had a real case here. And that was carried on to Carter. How do you deal with this? If a tribe has lost its land through treaty after 1790 and the federal government never entered into those treaties, then the Non-Intercourse Act had been violated. So the government had a trust obligation to them. The solution was not to go back to the courts and determine whether they should have the 12.5 million acres. What do you do with all of those private landholders inside, and who do you get the money? The first discussion, well, it was passed from the Carter administration to a former Supreme Court justice in the state of Georgia to for him to help them arrive at some decision. And his help was such that it was a sort of take it or leave it help. He gave them a plan. What he recommended was not that they receive 12 million acres or $25 billion, the value of those 12.5 million acres. But the Justice Gunter, the former justice, suggested the following, that the Passamaquoddy and Penobscot receive 100,000 acres. And that they be given $25 million for the land that they had lost. And that money was to be appropriated by Congress. He gave the tribe the option to buy another 400,000 acres with the monies that had been provided to them. And he told the state of Maine that they would have to convey some acreage. So he peeled it back then to perhaps 500,000 acres and with 100,000 acres thrown in by the state of Maine, but only 100,000 acres for sure. That's all he wanted to give them. And both the state of Maine and the Passamaquoddy Penobscot were displeased with this suggestion by the former justice. William Cohen, the senator from Maine, he called for a bill to extinguish the claim of aboriginal rights that were asserted by the Passamaquoddy and Penobscot. This snowballed with several other things that were going on in the nation at the time. The Steelhead Association on the West Coast and fly fishing associations were furious at the Judge Bolt's decision, 1974 decision, that they were going to allow Indians to grab all the anadromous species. The commercial fishermen were furious that they were going to get all the fish. The states and farmers in the Midwest, particularly on the over-allocated rivers, such as the Missouri, were furious that they were going to lose the water allocations that were already provided to them. In the Southwest, and particularly people along the Colorado, were also very anxious about Winter's Doctrine rights that were being asserted along the Colorado and in the Utah Water Compact. And so there was this large group that came together, and several bills were advanced. To outdo Cohen, there was a bill put into the House to deny all Aboriginal title to all Indians within the United States. This was Congressman Lloyd Meads of your great state of Washington at the time. And he was followed very soon by Representative Cunningham, who wanted to outdo the General Allotment Act. So he had a grand act to finally sever Indians from their tribes. Well, all of this was spinning around at the time of this Passamaquoddy-Penobscot deal. Saner heads seemed to come together, but I suspect that there must have been incredible pressures put on Passamaquoddy and Penobscot. That's why I wish that we had a representative here today to find out how they arrived at this. But in any event, the state of Maine passed an act. It took until 1980 to do it. And what they agreed to do was to provide land from state forests to the tribes. Now, they would provide the land, but the money had to come from someplace else. It had to come from the federal government. So, with encouragement from Senator Cohen and others, they beat down the backlash in Congress to pass any of this very extreme legislation. And in the Maine Implementing Act was passed in the state of Maine. And it did the following. When or if federal legislation was passed, extinguishing Indian claims to title, and if that legislation also provided funds to the tribes so that it would supplement the state's support without modifying the state act, they would provide land for purchase by the Passamaquoddy and Penobscot. There were several issues that hadn't been resolved, like the Maliseet Band popped up late in all of this, but they hadn't been involved in any of the cases. But they too had a claim to land, and that had to be resolved in this case. Well, the Passamaquoddy case, after the Maine Implementing Act was passed, was resolved by Congress in two acts. In the Maine Indian Claims Settlement Fund, they allocated $27 million. Half was held in trust for Passamaquoddy and half for the Penobscot. But they put real restrictions on how that money could be used. And they required that $1 million of that money would be used for the elderly members of each tribe and only off of the interest that was produced from that $1 million that was set aside. They also allocated $54.5 million in the Maine Indian Claims Land Acquisition Fund, $26.8 million for each tribe and $900,000 for the Maliseet. And that money was to be used to purchase land. And here's how much was available to them. They would receive 150,000 acres that would be purchased by that land, and 150,000 acres one for the Penobscot and one for Passamaquoddy, so 300,000 acres. And that land would be held in trust. There was an area designated in the state of Maine. If either tribe wished to purchase more land, if it was within the area designated by the state of Maine, they could do so, and that too would go into trust. So they could have more than 300,000 acres. If they chose to purchase land outside the area designated by the Maine Indian Act, they could do so, but it would be fee simple. The land would be held in fee simple. The funds that they were given were to be used for the development of commerce and industry and to run the tribe. Their tribal status, they were federally acknowledged, so they were, the tribe then had the right to create an IRA government, or each of them did if they wished, and to have benefit of all of the recent legislation that has been passed by the federal government, including the Indian Child Welfare Act, the Indian Education Act, the Indian Self-Determination and Educational Assistance Act, and so forth. So the outcome for them was not 12.5 million acres, $25 billion, but it was a hamburger, and that's, I'm sure, in their view, a lot better than what they went in with, and gives them a basis for the perpetuation of a culture that they deeply want to retain. Well, an interesting outcome in a very significant case.
Well, thank you, Mr. Jorgensen. I think this would be a good time to stop for lunch and to come back at 1:15 and then carry on in the order that I indicated earlier, if that's agreeable. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we'll begin again. And we've been joined by David Case, sitting next to Tim Coulter. David is legal advisor to the commission. And we've been joined by Al Guzmer of the United Tribes of Alaska, who's sitting next to Joe Jorgensen. And this afternoon, we'll hear from Ada Deer and Russell Jim and Tito Naranjo and Tim Coulter, and take as long as you wish, ladies and gentlemen, and if you want to say very little and reserve what you might think appropriate to be said tomorrow or the next day or the day after that, do whatever you think appropriate. Tim Coulter said to me that when we reach him this afternoon, we should all feel free to interrupt him with questions and observations, so I hope you'll all bear that in mind. And as we proceed, we'll carry on from there. Well, Ada Deer, would you like to begin then this afternoon?
Commissioner Berger, distinguished Indians and others, colleagues, it's really a tremendous opportunity for me to speak to you this afternoon, to relate to you some of the problems and the successes of the Menominee tribe. Many thoughts went through my mind as I listened to the summary and the review, the comments from the other speakers. What I hope to do is speak briefly and then have a lot more discussion, because in telling you about my tribe, the Menominee tribe, it will take a long time, and I do want to get to the issues and to the concerns that we all have as we discuss the ANSCA. First of all, I want to commend the ICC and others for their leadership and their foresight in calling together a group such as this to share information, to learn from one another. In order for you to understand where I'm coming from, I'd like to explain to you a little about my own background so you can hear my own biases and my own perceptions. I'm the oldest of five children, member of the Menominee tribe, white mother, Indian father, with a degree from the University of Wisconsin, and also a master's degree in social work from Columbia University in New York. I've been involved in Indian affairs for many years because as I grew up on the reservation, I often asked myself, why are Indians poor? Why do people have these problems? And I was the only college student who received the only tribal scholarship at the time. This was in 1953 when I entered the University of Wisconsin, and I was so appreciative and so excited about going to college and having the opportunity to get out of poverty that in the back of my mind I thought, well, someday I wish to repay the tribe in some way for this opportunity. I didn't really realize at that time what this would mean later on, but this was my thought at the time. The Menominee Termination Act was passed in 1954, and it did not become final until 1961, as many of you do know. Now, in 1954, I was a college student trying not to be a dropout. I knew that some extremely important actions were being taken, but I didn't know there was almost no information transmitted to the people of the tribe, and I felt that the best thing for me to do would be to continue to get through school and understand more about the larger society, get the tools and knowledge necessary to become involved in Indian affairs in some capacity later on. Termination is a cultural, economic, and political disaster. And my people, the Menominee people, suffered a great many injustices as a result of this act. Many people today still do not understand the details of termination. They have only suffered the hardships and the injustices. Now, being a social worker, I'm very concerned about the impact of policies and programs on people. And I wish to, again, commend all of those responsible for this meeting, because this is what we're talking about, the impact on people. We're not talking about, you know, fine theories and abstractions. We're talking about the lives of everyday people. Now, one of the myths that has followed the Menominees over the years is that the Menominees consented to termination. And I wish to correct that, because that's not really true. First of all, for those of you who may not know, the Menominees are located in Wisconsin. We have a beautiful reservation of trees, lakes, forests, streams. And we are one of the few tribes in the entire nation that is in our Aboriginal homeland. We were not removed because of the foresight of our leaders at that time. And I have my book here. It's not my book, it's Menominee's book, Freedom with Reservation. And this is a picture of Chief Oshkosh, who was involved at that time in negotiating and in working with the government people to not remove the Menominees west to Minnesota. Now, this is called Freedom with Reservation, the Menominee Struggle to Save Their Land and People. Land and people. A universal theme that American Indians and Alaska Natives have had throughout time. Land and people. And this is what really prompted and gave impetus to the restoration movement. I won't go into all of the injustices of the termination era. I will highlight a few of them. First of all, this began as a simple piece of legislation in the Congress. The Menominees had carried out a suit against the federal government for mismanagement of the trust. They had won. They had been awarded a sum of money, approximately $8.5 million. And our congressman at that time was Congressman Melvin Laird. He introduced a simple per capita bill, and this required or requested that a $1,500 per capita payment be given to each enrolled Menominee. And it got through the House in that form. When it got to the Senate, it was changed. And basically, Senator Watkins, that Professor Jorgensen spoke about earlier, stated that if the Menominees wanted their money, they would have to agree to termination. And there was a meeting out in our area. I didn't go because I was rather young and I wasn't that involved at that point. But at any rate, most of our people showed their opposition and their displeasure and their lack of understanding by not even going to the meeting. And there's this meeting where 169 people voted for the idea of termination and 5 people voted against it. That was only the idea. But this was only after Senator Watkins, you know, threatened and said that this was what was going to happen no matter what the Menominees wanted. A few weeks later, after more of this had become disseminated and people got a better idea of what this could mean, another meeting was called. And again, many people did not go because they did not understand the importance of it, and 197-0 voted against it. However, Senator Watkins took that first vote to Congress and said that there was, you know, approval by the Menominees for this. And if you know that at that point there were approximately 3,000 people in our tribe, 169-5 or 197-0 is a very, very small percentage of people, and they certainly were not informed. Now, the Termination Act became final in 1961, and there are several things I want to say about this. First of all the major policies on Indians have come from the top down. They have not come from the bottom up. They have not been based on the needs, the wishes, and the aspirations of the informed people at the grassroots level. And if we look at all of the examples that have been mentioned today, and I assume also last week, we can see that this is true. Now, in contrast, the Menominee Restoration Act came from the people, came from the bottom up. And I'm very proud to say that it's my tribe that worked to demonstrate what can be done by a small group of people who utilize the political process and who keep in mind their convictions and their dedication and their desires. I'm getting a little ahead of my story here. I like to talk. I don't like to give written speeches. speeches. So as the thoughts come to me, I'm going to talk with you about them. But to return to termination, what this meant the end of federal supervision over the Menominees. The Menominees would no longer be recognized as a federally recognized tribe, no longer eligible for services such as health services and education services. Our roles were to be closed, and it was really a devastating act to the people of the tribe. Great social disorganization and great psychological devastation resulted from termination. Many of our youngsters could not go on to vocational school, could not go on to college. Our hospital was closed. Now, this hospital had been there for many years. It did not meet state standards. And with the closing of the hospital, medical services became a serious problem. Many people suffered serious illnesses, and I don't know if this will ever be brought out, but I'm certain that a number of people died because of the lack of medical care. In 1961, Menominees became a county, and this again was another expression of the tribal feeling of the people. They did not want to become merged with the surrounding counties, and we became Wisconsin's newest and poorest county, 72nd county in the state of Wisconsin. One of the continuing themes that the majority culture never seems to hear is that Indians want to be Indians. Indians want to retain culture, want to retain land, and want to live as Indians live. Now, of course, this does vary from tribe to tribe and from region to region, but I really want to emphasize that despite many policies of the federal government, you know, over the years, from removal to putting people on reservations to allotment to assimilation, the continuing wish and desire of Indian people is to remain Indian. And this never seems to get across. Now, in thinking about the Dawes Act and the Termination Act, again, important parallels can be drawn. Some well-meaning, and I'm not so sure they were all well-meaning, do-gooders figuring out what should be done for the Indian people. Now, as a social worker and as a human being, I have very strong values. I feel that we have to respect one another, that we have to work with people and not do things to people or for people. Now, that, of course, requires a lot of work, a lot of sensitivity, a lot of understanding, which has never really been adequately demonstrated on behalf of the government in working with Indians. At any rate, we have these power brokers there deciding again what is going to be done for people without their consultation, really, and without their understanding. Another policy of forced assimilation. Now, under termination, many of our people moved away from the reservations. They moved to some of the urban areas, Milwaukee and Chicago, and you know, various other places. And they had a lot of serious problems. You talk with the people in the urban areas at that time, they can tell you the hardships. I remember an old man, a traditional man from one of the rural communities on my reservation, saying, I remember looking at myself on, one day I'm an Indian and the next day I'm not, but yet I'm the same person. And he didn't understand all of the legal complexities. And I have to tell you that I do not fully understand myself all the provisions and the functionings and implementation of ANSCA. I venture to say that a lot of other people up here don't either. And probably many of the native people don't understand the complications of the ANSCA legislation. During this termination time, a number of people tried to do something about this, but they didn't know what to do and they didn't know how to do it. And they got discouraged and didn't really focus the necessary energies, get the necessary resources to do something about this. So I want to bring this out because there was always this opposition to termination. And there were a number of committees that were formed and various other activities, such as a petition was sent in, and that was the last most people ever heard of it again. But people didn't really understand what could be done about it. Now, I have met a number of people who were in Washington at that time and who tell me that some of the people from my tribe went to Washington and more or less acquiesced to this idea of termination. I'm not sure about this, but I think it's important to understand that the perceptions of people. I think that it's often easy to look back at something with hindsight. But if we recall and if we all remember and understand the force with which this government has thrust policies onto Indians, it's easy to see why some people may acquiesce too easily and we may misinterpret this. I think the fact that many of the leaders went to boarding schools, went to these mission schools, and did not have a sufficient education resulted in some of this acquiescence. One of the points I want to bring out here for every one of you, native and non-native, and scholars and academicians and others, is that, you know, the government is there to be influenced. Who's the government? We are the government. And I think that the years of dependence and oppression under which many Indian people have lived results in an undue acquiescence to people in the power structure. Now, I have to tell you that I am enjoying a great deal getting older. I'm 48 years old. I can hardly wait till I'm 50. You know, I'm going to give myself a blast-off party when I'm 50 to blast myself into the, you know, second half. I am not underwhelmed by anybody. I am not overwhelmed by anybody. I respect all people, and I demand respect from all people. And I think that in too many instances, the bureaucrats, the lawyers, and the professional people intimidate Indians and others. And I want to especially emphasize to the Alaska Natives and other Indians who may be attending and who will be observing and reading these transcripts that we live in a democracy and that the government is there to be responsive to our needs. I'm getting a little off the subject, but these all relate to one another. At any rate, in 1969, I came back to Wisconsin after working in Minnesota in a number of capacities there, including the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and in which I decided after 3 years that I didn't want to be a BIA Indian, that my various memos and things weren't really paid any attention to, and I knew that I wanted to be involved with Indian affairs and trying to rectify some of the injustices, and so I left. At any rate, I came back and started getting involved with my tribal affairs and activities. And I won't go into all of this except to say that I started going to meetings trying to find out what this all meant. Now, I had a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, and almost 10 years experience, and I'm trying to find out and understand what termination was. And the more I found out about it, the angrier I got. And I felt that there was a lot of jargon that was injected, a lot of academese that was foisted on our people, and there was very little attempt to help people understand. Now, you cannot understand the feelings that people had about closing the rolls. If I had been in a position of power at that time, I would have kept the rolls open anyway. But at any rate, the rolls were closed, and no one could be enrolled as a member of the tribe. Now, this is something that's coming up here in Alaska in 1991 with the shares being thrown open, and the children after 1971 not being enrolled. Our land became subject to taxation, and let me briefly sketch for you what resulted after termination. First of all, our tribe had a general council. Every adult was eligible to come and to vote, and there was an advisory council consisting of 12 members, and they met from time to time during the year to carry on the business of the tribe. Well, from 1954 to 1961, there was a Menominee coordinating and negotiating committee consisting of people from the tribal leadership, people from the federal government and the state government, and they had many, many meetings, which, again, people did not understand. At any rate, termination became final in 1961. For those of you that want a lot more information on this, there is this book here, Freedom with Reservation, and Rosita Wuerl has a copy of this. I'm not sure if there are any other copies up here in the libraries, but there should be. And it briefly sketches the problems of termination. Now, some of the speakers have talked about the importance of sovereignty and the political institutions. Also the corporations and the economic implications for the people. With the Termination Act becoming final, the rolls were closed, our land became subject to taxation, that was in 1961, and we were no longer eligible for any services. Now, many people think that the Menominees were rich people. As a tribe, we have resources, we have land, and we did have a large amount of money from the suit. But individually, the Menominees were very poor. And yes, $1,500 seemed like a lot of money. I took my $1,500, borrowed more, and went to graduate school. Other people did other things with their money. Now, the structure of the governing body was drastically changed. First of all, at the bottom we have the Menominees. We were called certificate holders. This boggled my mind, certificate holders, okay? Then we have the Menominee Common Stock and Voting Trust, and they in turn elected the Board of Directors of Menominee Enterprises, Inc., which is a state corporation. So we went from being a tribe to being a state corporation. Now, that may not sound so complicated to you, but it certainly was, because there was another trust established. This was the First Wisconsin Trust Company of Milwaukee. This was a white institution that voted the shares for the miners and the incompetents. Now, when termination occurred, each Menominee was given a bond worth $3,000 in the year 2000 and a certificate of beneficial interest. Now, I talked to our lawyers about the certificate of beneficial interest, and I was informed that we are the only entity that has ever been issued a certificate of beneficial interest. This is another example of the creativity on the mind of man, especially some lawyers. Now, you have to understand, I have kind of a love-hate relationship with lawyers. On the one hand, we need some of their legal expertise. On the other hand, we have to keep them in line. And I don't think that Native people often keep their lawyers in line enough. And as a result, we get bad law and bad precedents that affect all tribes, not only one tribe. So when we, when I was trying to understand all this, I knew I needed a lawyer. So being in the Upward Bound program, which was a part of the OEO program, I decided to look around for an OEO lawyer, which I found. Joseph Prilasnik of Madison, Wisconsin, was the director of Wisconsin Judicare at that time. And we started meeting. I told him who I was and what I wanted. And he said, well, he'd be happy to meet with me, that he would need, however, he would need more than one client. So I said, oh, well, okay, that's easy. I said, I'll promise you two more. And he said, who are they? And I said, my brother and my sister. See, every now and then I exercise my prerogatives as the oldest person. Then he said, well, a lot of Menominees have come to me over the years, and they've gotten pressured out. And I said, listen, nobody pressures me. When I decide I want to do something, you know, I do it. And first of all, I want to understand what all this is, because it's a very important matter for all of our people. And we started unraveling all of this. And like I say, the more I understood this, the angrier I got. And it took us took me a long time to understand the implications of this and the structure of this. Now, one of the things that continually infuriates me is the paternalism and the racism with which the government has acted toward Indians. Now, the first Wisconsin Trust Company was appointed trustee. They had over 40% of the votes. Now, the parents were competent to take care of these youngsters, their children, during the year, but they were not competent to vote the shares. People were declared incompetent without due process of law. Some lady on the reservation kind of drew up a list of people and said that maybe they weren't taking care of their kids the best way, and some of them had alcoholic problems and so on. Anyway, there was this long list of people that were declared incompetent without due process of law. And so the control was not in the hands of the Menominees. The control was in the hands of this First Wisconsin Trust Company of Milwaukee. And they met from time to time and decided who was going to be on the board of directors. First of all, on the board of trustees, and then the board of trustees would decide who was going to be on the board of directors. And there was a mixture of people, both Indians and non-Indians on these boards. But I contend they weren't the right kind of Indians. They weren't the right kind of people who really looked to see what the impact of their decisions was on the people and what was in the best interest of the tribe. And again, I feel that there's too much acceptance by people of what the government does and what the lawyers say. And I think that everyone, lawyers and others alike, we have to have more vision. We have to have more sense of what's right and what's wrong as these kinds of policies and bills are enacted. At any rate, what happened was the board of directors, without the consent of the Menominees, voted to get into a partnership with a land developer and started a joint venture. At any rate, pretty soon there were bulldozers up there bulldozing the trees down on one of our most beautiful lakes. And you have to understand, we had a reservation. It was about 235,000 acres, beautiful lakes, and it was not allotted. And people, if they felt like going to the lake, they went to the lake. If they felt like going fishing, they went fishing. And you didn't have to ask anybody if you could go wherever you wanted to go, you could go. At any rate, what happened spontaneously was a number of youngsters were thrown out from one of the lakes, and this made the parents very angry. And so demonstrations started occurring. And I thought, oh, wow, this sounds interesting. Now, I have not been to Saul Alinsky's school in Chicago, but I have a lot of anger. And one of the advantages of going to school is to learn how to analyze and to discuss and discover strategies. So about that time, I started having discussions with our lawyer about what could be done. And we started meeting with other people, too. We started meeting with other members of our tribe. Because again, I want to say that many people wanted to fight termination. They weren't quite sure how they could do it or what should be done, but they were willing to do this. So when demonstrations started occurring, then we went up there. We were only a very short distance away, and so we started taking part in these demonstrations. We formed a movement called DRUMS, Determination of Rights and Unity for Menominee Shareholders. And our thrust was to stop the land sales, to work for restoration, and to have Menominees in the positions of power. Now, this movement all started about 1969, 1970. And when you think about how long it takes to get a law through Congress, or bill through Congress, it was a very short time. Our Menominee restoration legislation was signed into law on December 22, 1973. But again, I want to emphasize the long discussions and the opposition to termination that our people had. At any rate, we had many meetings. We drafted up a legislation, and there are still people that are unhappy with the restoration legislation because they didn't understand the legislative process, that there has to be compromise. Some people thought that because they came to a meeting and they gave their ideas that they would be automatically included and that's what would happen. At any rate, for those of you that are interested, you can certainly study the restoration legislation. But we did get the Menominee tribe restored. We opened up the rolls. We started a whole new relationship with the federal government. And people ask, well, how are the Menominees doing now? I say, well,